This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking about cancer as a factor in mental health with Matthew Zachary. And this is a theme we've wanted to cover for some time. Of course, we very much included it in previous conversations with Sophie Savage in particular. People want further listening around this. Some of the most powerful conversations I've had are with her. But it has very much been on our to-do list to devote an entire episode to this. And knowing just how massive the impact has been, certainly in my own family and that of so many people that I know, the ripple effect, you know, not just the individual's mental health, but also, as we talk about in the episode, the experiences of those around somebody that's dealing with a cancer diagnosis and subsequent treatment and prognoses. So to start off, we've got some information from the Mental Health Foundation to set the scene. As many people will know only too well, cancer and the associated symptoms, treatment, and aftermath can have significant emotional impact on patients, their relatives, and carers. The experience of being diagnosed, feelings of hopelessness and uncertainty around survival can all have a detrimental impact on a patient's well-being.
In addition, the stigma surrounding both mental and physical health conditions, such as lung cancer, can exacerbate feelings of guilt and shame. The physical symptoms of specific cancers can also impact mental health, such as hair loss or sexual dysfunction.
These are some of the factors that together place people living with cancer at heightened risk of developing common mental health conditions. Despite this, the combination of cancer and poor mental health has generally received little research attention. And we see that all the time. How many areas of mental health do we see limited research? And so it's good to see that the Mental Health Foundation are calling that out as well, because this is often the case. And actually, talking to the guest, he very much shares, whilst things have moved on a lot since he was first diagnosed, at the time when he was, there was almost no mental health support because it was just seen the priority and the only priority is you beat the cancer and you survive. But that doesn't mean there's not emotional scars left, even though from a physical health point of view, it was, this is a great success, right?
Yeah, because I guess, like you said, the focus is so much on the physical and trying to get through that from everybody's point of view. But the lasting impact on, like you said, your friends and your family and yourself and just the way it leaves you maybe can change some people completely. It can give, you know, even the positive. Somebody I was talking to not long ago said, you know, 3 years since their cancer diagnosis and, you know, they'd been back for their checks and everything seemed fine. They'd given them a completely brand new lease of life and they were just loving everything in life and having all these amazing experiences and just being, you know, on this whole life too short. But even that had an impact on family and friends who couldn't keep up. Just couldn't keep up with that.
No, it's really difficult. And I think there's no, like a lot of situations, there's no ideal way to do it, right? Because when someone's going through this, particularly the diagnosis that Matthew, our guest, will share, there is, of course, a natural rallying round of a family. And that's, you know, totally understandable. And that support is incredible. But also, there's complications that can come there around the pressure and the guilt he felt around feeling like he was making a fuss, even though he was just trying to get through every day, but he felt like he was having this massive impact on other people's lives who have their own things going on as well. You know, he's not the only person going through things, even if he is understandably a priority at that point. And I think that is really difficult to navigate, and all the just the different factors, like it mentioned in what we read out about stigma around particular conditions, such as lung cancer. And that's definitely something I've observed, where people will jump to the assumption of, oh, well, it must have been smoking, it must be your fault. And that's not helpful. You know, we know that there are such dangers for your health of smoking. But when someone's ill and they're dealing with the severity of lung cancer, they need support. There's nothing helpful about them being like, oh, well, you did this to yourself. And yet I have heard people share that they've had that kind of reception. And that doesn't feel that far away from some of the things we hear when it comes to mental health. You know, that's why stigma, exactly the right word there, because there are plenty of times when people are blamed. And actually, I think it's less about whether or not you feel like there's anything to that blame and more about the fact that it's not helpful, you know? Because after all, first of all, they may not be a smoker. Second of all, even if they are, the focus surely should be not on shaming them, which might get them to continue smoking or even take it back up if they've stopped. But instead, how can we make sure you don't go back to that and empower you to find coping mechanisms for this really difficult time that aren't going to potentially make you iller, if that was even a factor in the first place? One of the stats actually from the Mental Health Foundation around this is that the prevalence of depression is highest in patients with lung cancer. And I do wonder about that stigma link there.
Yeah. And we know that it's there, Bob, because we have probably all said it ourselves at some point when we've described a cancer, especially lung cancer, that, you know, if somebody has been diagnosed or you're telling a story that you've overheard from the news or whatever, and you'll say, you know, he'd never even touched a cigarette, or he'd never drunk alcohol, he wasn't overweight, or, you know, all of those things that we put in place to what? So it makes it easier for us to support that person, or, you know, the things that we say to kind of hope that the person will get, you know, more love, if you like, as if they had smoked 40 cigarettes a day, that means we're going to say it's your own fault and dismiss them. Like, oh, but they haven't. Oh, but they didn't. And it's exactly the same with mental health, isn't it? I mean, they've been brought up so well, great family. So we just don't know how come they're self-harming or they're feeling depressed. You know what I mean? We do that in society. That's stigma right there.
Very true. Great point. And a lot of that does come from just the difficulty of wrapping your head around it. But very much that can be received, whether you mean it in this way or not, as there are people that deserve cancer. And that's a very dangerous thing, of course, for somebody to hear. And yeah, could be so incredibly hurtful, whichever side of that they might be saying you're on, actually. And so, yeah, it's probably one of those things where I can understand a lot of why those conversations come up, but maybe it's a case of that, like certain other conversations, it's time to go in the bin. And I mentioned there a statistic from the Mental Health Foundation. We have some more from them. They've got loads of great information around this on their website. So they report that estimates vary widely when it comes to the prevalence of common mental health conditions among those with cancer. And it's anything from between 4% and 49%, depending on the condition. So massive range, but very clear link. And taking one example here, ovarian cancer, we see that anxiety tends to be higher following treatment and during treatment, and is lowest before treatment. Whereas depression is higher before treatment, reduces slightly during treatment, and again following treatment. And first of all, the prevalence there is massive, even before we get into the differences, but also really fascinating to see when the anxiety and depression prevalence is its highest. And I think it really highlights a lot of the challenges that maybe people overlook. You know, we think about the difficulty of getting the diagnosis, the difficulty of how that recovery goes, but actually the treatment so often is a whole different set of challenges in itself. This, like our guest shares, the things that were making him better at times very much felt like they were making him sicker. And I can definitely see why your anxiety could be shooting up during that. Whereas by contrast, depression potentially being a bit less. So you're finding the anxiety of the treatment may be up, but your outlook might be looking better, and that might have a positive influence on depression levels, right? It's kind of what it seems to paint.
Yeah, I agree totally. You can see why.
And so it was really great chatting to Matthew, as someone who is a fellow podcaster, someone that does an incredible amount of campaigning around the experience of going through cancer diagnosis and what comes next. And so such a real voice about this, but also a kind of unexpected voice, that as much as I was aware of his work and had come across his very successful podcast, which I would recommend, actually getting to chat to him in person, it did take me a moment to settle into, you know, the lighthearted way that he can talk about some of the very serious topics that come up. So it's ended up being a surprisingly upbeat conversation for the serious nature of the topic. And I think the listeners will get a lot from that in terms of he's clearly done a lot of the work to process this, to get through it, to find ways to sort of fit various experiences into his past in a way that feels comfortable to have a joke at, but also talk about, okay, things still need to change. Things have got better, I've got better, but change is still needed. So yeah, very, very nuanced conversation, and I got so much from it.
Absolutely fantastic. And I think, you know, we've all come to a point, haven't we, Bob, where we have to find some strength to be able to, down the line, and maybe it does come after the fact or after, you know, the hardest times, whatever it might be, you know, that we can look back with some humour or we can support people with some humour. And, you know, you mentioned him being lighthearted to a certain degree. And I think also it gives you the strength. And we say this a lot about our own mental health journeys, that without them, we might not have the strength to talk the way that we do, to face other things in our lives, the resilience that comes with it. So I think there's so much positive. It sounds so cliche, but so much positive that can come from these shitty times in our lives, and a different perspective can be really empowering. So I love that. Great guest.
Yes. And I think the word you've got me thinking about is hopeful. That's what his outlook is. That is what I got from this episode. And I think that's very much what we need, whether it's talking about specifically going through cancer treatment yourself, but just in general about healthcare moving forward, a better understanding of physical and mental health not being something where you can choose to treat one or the other. You know, both always need to be considered. So with that all said, we'll get into the episode in a moment with Matthew Zachary. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. We love chat here at Mental, so we're delighted to be partnering with the Michelle Thomas Method, a pioneering format for picking up a new language.
Michelle Thomas designed this innovative audio-only approach around his belief that language learning should be fun and stress-free. That's why there's no homework, no vocal lists or textbooks, so you can just sit back and enjoy the process.
By breaking languages down into logical chunks and using seamless memory techniques, I've been so impressed by how quickly I'm picking up new phrases and finding ways to build sentences in French, a language I've picked up much slower when trying to learn from classes or phrase books in the past.
Plus, you can learn anytime on your phone or computer, so you can easily make this a part of your routine. We really would recommend this to anyone looking to pick up another language quickly and seamlessly.
As one of our listeners, you can claim 25% off at michellethomas.com. That's michellethomas.com with code HEALTH at checkout to claim that 25% off any course. This is your last chance to redeem this offer, so go get it.
The Michelle Thomas Method. Learn a language for good.
I've heard a new phrase. I don't know who makes these things up. It's called Zezers. X-E-E-Z-E-R-S. And those are Gen X geezers. Because we're too young to be actual geezers, but we're old enough to not know what the hell was wrong with anyone growing up. So we come from a time where it wasn't quite getting hit with a belt by your dad, but it was kind of like, get over yourself, buckle up, or buck up, and just do what you got to do. So there was kind of like no remorse, no awareness. So my perspective on what mental health is very skewed, because I don't quite know what it is, because it seems to be everything. And when something is everything, it's kind of nothing. So I want to learn from you on this conversation how I, as a Zezer, get a little more woke on what the hell this really is, because I still deal with all of this personally. I worked in cancer survivorship and advocacy, and we used to call it psychosocial well-being. Is that the academic word for mental health? I don't know. So a fairly long introduction to what I don't know quite is mental health, but it just seems to make sense that I am in the right place to be on this show with you.
Good. And I think that's similar to a lot of our guests, that they start off by saying, well, actually, this wasn't talked about, or if it was, it was talked about in a stigmatizing way when I was growing up. And so you've got that difficulty of, okay, I need to unpick the language and the stuff that I know is inappropriate, but I also need to find language to replace it. And
right.
That combined with the fact that so often the stigma means people, when they're struggling, don't feel they can speak up, makes it very difficult to have a voice about this at all. And so would you mind sharing a bit of where your head was at in terms of pre-diagnosis and then into what that diagnosis was like and how that affected, of course, your physical, but also what was going on internally for you?
In the lens of 1995, so a very long time ago, we didn't think about these things, but I was about to start my senior year of college, and I had been accepted to grad school the following year to go into to film composition studies at USC. And when I got back to school, I had been playing, I don't know, 60 hours a week normally. I took the summer off, and I got back, and my left hand wouldn't arpeggiate. That means moving your fingers fairly quickly up and down the keyboard. And I'm like, well, that's weird. I didn't think anything of it. And then over time, I just started playing piano worse with my left hand. And eventually I got these weird headaches in the back of my head. And I just kind of powered through it. I didn't think anything was wrong with me. And eventually, maybe there's something wrong with me. And I went to the doctors on campus and I kept getting misdiagnosed. So I guess I got frustrated that something was wrong with me, but no one took me seriously. But I didn't really care about it because I wanted to just graduate and do my thing. And eventually, over, I guess, Thanksgiving break here in the States in November, and he said, yeah, there's something really wrong with you. Let's get you some tests. And like, thank God there's something wrong with me. Little did we realize that I had a brain tumor that they didn't yet know was cancer. So I feel like I'm telling someone else's story at this point after 26 years, but I don't remember freaking out. I don't remember anything. Maybe I was just in like this dystopic state of denial, but it really wasn't until I actually had to call USC and tell them I couldn't go because I might be dead in 6 months. But mortality wasn't even something that scared me. I don't know why, looking back. I just kind of was at that point. And then everything kind of really, I'd say the shit really hit the fan months after my treatment was over.
Right. And so you get the initial diagnosis, you're told you've got 6 months, and it sounds like perhaps partly the shock of that sort of numbed you out, because how do you as a 21-year-old contemplate that you are that close to death when so much of, I think, your identity at that age, particularly in education, is about being young, and you're almost kind of held up for your youth and your potential in academia. That's who you are. And so then to have the contrast between that and, oh, actually, you're nearing the end of your life. I've no idea, personally, how you would wrap your head around that.
You're supposed to be invincible, right? There's actually an invincibility gene in your body that slowly fades away in your 20s because you don't stop growing till you're like 22 or 23. So you're supposed to be invincible. You're supposed to not have fears, which is why, you know, kids jump off roofs and do stupid things on TikTok because they don't fear death. Like, I can't even imagine. How are you kids doing these things? I didn't feel any threat. It didn't even remotely occur to me that I could die. And if that was just conscious denial coupled with invincibility at 21, I'll take it. But yeah, I mean, I would say through any trauma that hopefully does have a finish line, the worst day is the last. For many people with cancer, the last day of treatment is never the last day of being a cancer patient or a cancer survivor, because there's this boat wake of crap you then have to deal with afterwards, which, at least for me, were directly related to the Chernobyl level or Fukushima level radiation and toxicity that I went through. So I may have been cured, but I wasn't well. I wasn't done. You know, you put something in an easy bake oven, you know, you eat the toast, but there's crap in the oven left over. You got to clean the oven. It takes a long time to clean the oven. So again, for me, I was on this incredibly toxic treatment that they barely even give anymore. Again, everything in context to 1996. But, you know, I think where if I want to start to think about what mental health challenges I went through, I was isolated and depressed because all my friends went to grad school and I was home alone back on my parents' couch and I was supposed to be in LA. And here I am stuck in a bed with no hair. I'm infertile. I'm impotent. My friends go away. I have no peer-to-peer. I didn't even know. Back then, you didn't even know there was someone like you because you couldn't conceive of the, you know, geezers, not zeezers, get cancer, right? And whatever I was back then, there were no people like me. So I think just the not knowing what I needed was okay because I didn't know I needed it. But once I realized there were things that I wished I had had, that's when I started getting really angry. Having to deal with the crap as a result of being quote unquote cured was the hardest struggle of my 20s, but I didn't know any different.
Yeah. And it sounds like that must have been really anticlimactic then, or the huge contrast between you've got 6 months and then, in fact, you do recover and the treatment does work. But of course, you feel awful in part because of the treatment, necessary as it may be. And then you're recovering and that's incredible that you can get past this thing. But then the life you're going to isn't going back to your normal. And so there isn't the kind of rosy success that it might be for the medical professionals to be like, you've survived and that's much of our job done.
Yeah, I mean, my doctor may have cured me of cancer, but they didn't help me figure out what to do afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, you're living with your parents. What comes next in terms of your hopes for the future and rebuilding those?
Well, the only thing that mattered to me at the time was being able to play piano again. My right hand kept working, but my left hand was like this limp nub that couldn't even, I mean, I'm making visuals on a podcast for the listeners. You shouldn't be doing
making
that.
Making a fist.
But my fingers,
yeah.
I'm making a fist. Yeah, like I couldn't play piano. I couldn't play scales. I had to retake. So I made, the only thing I had control over was, could I possibly ever play piano again? And I started to rehabilitate myself. And again, today they'd give you physical therapy. They'd give you social work, like nothing. All right, good luck, kid. Go play piano again one day. So I spent 5 years just rehabilitating myself to a point where I personally, as an artist, felt it was as close as it could be. But that didn't pay the bills. My dad said to me, if you're going to die, die employed. True story. So in my whatever slowly recovering immunodeficient state of hair loss or whatever, I moved out. I got a job. I moved in with an old Binghamton alumni friend of mine who was very empathetic to my situation but didn't understand what I was going through. And I started a whole new career, Plan B, which I didn't really have, became Plan A. And I spent 10 years in advertising, marketing, new media, tech, fixing Macintoshes. And I built a second life for myself, not even knowing if I'd be alive. I should comment that once I lived 6 months, they're like, yay, you're here. I'm clapping on the air. And I said, well, when am I going to die now? And they said, we're going to give you a 50% chance to live for 5 years. And I said, that sucks.
Wait, why does that sound like a so, game show the way that was presented?
I know. Regis Philbin said, 50% chance for $5. And literally, as I'm coasting towards 5 years, which back then was like a magic number, you know, if you made 5 years, you'll die of something else, was like the running joke. You know, I never thought I'd make 5 years, but I didn't really care. I'm like, hey, I'll just play piano, see what happens. I never, ever once felt afraid of death, no matter what happened. And maybe that's just instinctive in me, not unique to many people. But I feel like, again, I didn't know what I was missing. My 20s sucked in hindsight compared to everyone else that was doing what they're supposed to do in their 20s. I didn't do any of it. None of it. And it wasn't really until, I guess, I finally met someone who was like me that I'm like, holy shit, how did I not know these things for 7 years? And that's what I remain pissed about. Mm-hmm.
And so what was that experience like getting to talk through this with a peer for the first time?
Well, his name is Craig. I mean, I went from like being completely isolated to the deepest end of the pool in like a day. Because Craig not only was bald, Jewish, from New York City, and had the same brain tumor as me. He went to my university and graduated the year I got there, and I didn't know him. And we were in the same a cappella group, and I just didn't know him. So, brain explosion. Like, they could not have been a better human on the planet to stumble upon in 2002 than Craig. So, I was like, I didn't know someone understood what I was going through to begin with. But another guy who was also bald Jewish from New York City, artist, a cappella guy, and long-term survivor, it was like I struck gold in meeting someone like me. I could not have asked for someone else more empathetic and understanding of what I didn't even know how to express at the time. So, you know, instead of the car crashing into the wall, I crashed into like, I don't know, like foam. Everything just came to a really safe end of what I didn't know I was missing and needed. It was just cathartic to meet someone who got it because they had it. Sorry, that's a dad joke.
And what were the things you remember talking the most about in terms of going through the recovery process? And it sounds like there was a lot of things that weren't addressed in the conversations you had with the medical professionals, that of course, with a condition like you had, there is such an understandable focus on the physical, but then it sounds like there was so much lacking in terms of how do you support somebody so young with the idea of imminent mortality? Well, surely more conversations than you had.
I think what Craig helped me discover was how much guilt I felt for putting my family through this. And that's something that's known as survivor guilt. Why am I still here when someone else died? Why am I still here and God, look what I put my loved ones through. They didn't ask for this. They went through hell and back, my poor brother, my poor mom, my poor dad, right? It was the worst hell that you could never wish on anyone you care about. And I'm responsible for that. And it's not my fault, no one's fault, it's cross to bear. It's another aspect of just human nature. But I think meeting Craig helped me identify with that more than anything else, because he felt the same way about what he put his parents and his siblings through for years and years and years. I mean, I'm over that now, but that impacted my parents and my brother for the rest of their lives. That, to me, it wasn't even about me. I'll figure out how to be fine. I'm resilient, I'm whatever. I'm not like macho where I don't want help, but I didn't ever feel like I needed a pat on the back or, you know, they're giving out wristbands back then. Like, oh, cancer wristbands. You know you made it when you wear a freaking cancer wristband. I didn't care about that stuff. I cared about how what I had gone through affected other people.
Yeah, and I think that's so common with a lot of conditions, particularly when you've had that experience of going through hospital style support and you've seen the faces of the people that didn't make it through and you've seen the impact on their family, you know, and so you get that sort of collective trauma in addition to what you've been through with yourself and your own family.
Yeah, and I made a choice. I know we're kind of going ahead a little bit, but I made a choice to dive into this world of helping other cancer patients because that's what Craig was doing at the time. Again, like the most perfect human to have ever met in that moment. He worked in DC here in the States in cancer policy for the largest, most influential cancer organization in the US. He worked for them. He was on their board. And he pulled me right into that space. And I asked him, like, how can I help? And he said, how would you like to be a cancer advocate? And I said, what the hell's a cancer advocate? He's like, follow me. So down the yellow brick road we went. And over the years, yes, I've met so many thousands of people. Many have died, and you have guilt. How am I still here? What did they do wrong or right? What did I do wrong or right? Is there wrong or right? How do you reconcile being in this place where they didn't make it and somehow I'm still here 26 years later? I have no idea how the hell I'm still here. There's no reason I should be here, but I am. And, you know, I think maybe my transference into acceptance of what I had gone through was made up for by entering the cancer advocate universe and starting the nonprofit that I did, Stupid Cancer, and really trying to do more because I wanted to build something that I wished that I had.
Yeah, and that very much chimes with a lot of my experience starting this podcast of seeing all the gaps that oftentimes it takes going through an experience to really see. And I can see how powerful that can be for, I guess, offsetting, is that the right word? Some of that guilt that you were feeling of, okay, I'm doing something, I'm giving something back. So this thing that has hijacked my life and has taken years from me, that I don't know what I would have been doing otherwise, I get to turn that into something positive, give back, look out for others, and with the work you do, even go, you know, years into the future and, okay, what can we change today that will impact people going forward?
Yeah, I mean, my plan A was gone forever. I was never going to be a concert pianist. I was too sick to go to grad school. It took me years to build up an immune system again. Again, like, you're cured, go home. Not the end of the story. And back then, again, there were no drugs to improve your white cells, to get your brain functioning again, to get your blood better. There were no rehabilitation drugs at the time. Today, it's a whole different story. In fact, let's take into context the little tongue-in-cheek dark humor here. Being fucked up in the head because you had cancer is a good problem to have because it means you're alive versus just dropping dead in 6 months, 20 years ago. Okay, so the fact that that system is there to envelop you, and we're using the term mental health, I am pro all of this. I'm pro progress. But I think you're right. In recompense, Plan B got me to Plan C, which was to be a cancer advocate and work in the policy space and the research space and the advocate space to date for 18 years now, 17 years now. So I feel like, to answer your question, which I think you asked. Yeah, chemo brain is real, folks. Chemo brain is real. The idea that you want to be there for the next you is not a new concept, right? You mentioned you started your show because it's something probably you or people you love wished they had this level of dogmatic support of people that get it and understand you and know what you're going through, that aren't like the Hallmark card greeting people that don't mean harm when they say these things to you. But they don't quite get it because they haven't been through it themselves. Not their fault. But at the end of the day, if your goal, at least mine, was to make sure that that poor 21-year-old was told he's going to be okay and there's people like you and you're going to be, whatever's going to happen, we got your back, that's what I needed.
And I think a lot of that is the impact this is going to have on your life in a distinct and unique way that needs to have time to be grieved and be discussed and analyzed in a way where you can try and come to terms with it. Because something that I'm particularly interested in your perspective on is having gone through a time where so much of cancer diagnosis was seen as a death notice, there is something I think very dehumanizing about that specific experience of this is the number of months you've got left, this is what the mortality percentage is, or this is what other people go through. And it's a way of holding you up against anonymous other people who all have their own stories but are treated like statistics, and then you yourself are treated like a statistic.
Well, that was the way. In this documentary we'll talk about called The Cancer Mavericks, we talk about 50 years of cancer advocacy, at least here in the U.S., and you were victims, they didn't care about you, your data point, your biology, you weren't a human. And it wasn't in the sense that your doctors weren't empathetic. I'm sure percentages of them have always been empathetic, but they never thought about you as a person. They thought about you as a biology point. And that was what I experienced as a point in time that I'm happy isn't what it is anymore. But again, I go back to this word psychosocial. Was the first time I heard that word psychosocial was when I got involved with Livestrong, which was years and years and years ago, like 2000, 2003, 2004, before its fairly famous collapse. And they used the word psychosocial, which I think is a variant of, actually variant's a bad word these days, a version of mental health. Your well-being, the practical issues you deal with. How do you deal with dating and infertility when you're younger and getting a job and gaps in your resume and depression and stress and anxiety? Like, who doesn't have that, but how do you manage it? Wasn't even a thing. And Livestrong's talking about this and like, wow, you know what? Maybe I have stress and anxiety above the stress and anxiety I have because I'm somehow still here, cresting towards 10 years alive somehow and getting tests every month, and every other test creates more stress and anxiety. I think the cancer survivorship movement helped create the idea of mental health in oncology, at least. This is not a new idea in the annals of human history. You know, meditation and mindfulness have been in Eastern cultures for, 10,000 years? They know this shit. We're late to the game in this shit. But I really had wished that that stuff was available to me in the 90s, but I'm glad I was able to help participate in the very early genesis of the science that made it, again, U.S. healthcare, a covered benefit that was free when you needed it when you get cancer.
Yeah, which is such incredible progress. But I think we still always have to find the space for those individuals and for their stories and their experiences. And that's my understanding of your work that you've mentioned with the Cancer Mavericks, that you want to look at the individual experiences, the human perspective, almost like, you know, cancer from the inside looking out.
Well, again, it's also like, you know, we used to be defined by the bad things that happened to us. You have cancer, you had cancer, you're living with cancer, and there's no finish line, or there's a finish line. All right, you entered like a shit happens store that you never wanted to shop in before. Like, no one wakes up and says, I can't wait to get leukemia and get help from the Teenage Cancer Trust. Like, no one, that doesn't occur to people. Why would you want that to ever happen to you? So when you're thrust into a crisis situation, it's like any other crisis situation you're thrust into, whether it's the military or a car accident or an instant loss. It's just different. It's not apples to apples. There are common threads through all of those experiences. And it's being given permission that you're in this space, it's not okay, and when you're ready, there are opportunities to make it suck less.
And I love that phrase, suck less. So what kind of things did you find through your recovery that helped things suck less, not just the physical side, but the emotional side as well?
Well, it took me 5 years, but I was able to regain not the full use of my left hand, but to the point where I was able to start composing again and giving piano concerts, which is still the soul of me, is playing piano and giving piano concerts outside of all the other stuff that I do. In fact, today, most people don't even know I play piano. You know, they just know me from my advocacy work. And fun fact of the day, the soundtrack to Cancer Mavericks is me. I wrote it. So kind of a full circle 25 years later. But how I dealt with all of that in the salad days of the early 2000s was just trying to play piano, write music, and just zen out the best I can in my job, which I actually enjoyed having. And there's a bit of a dopamine hit in meeting other people like you, where you're instant friends, and there's no judgments, and it's not about, oh, you had lung cancer? I had colon cancer. You go away, because I'm going to stick with the colon cancer people. Like, my generation, the Gen Xers, we changed all that. We made it very egalitarian. And the war on geography, which is what we call like where your body part is with cancer, is kind of over to an extent in terms of once you look at mental health. Your mental health may vary depending on if you have an ostomy bag, you have to worry about your physiognomy because you have a scar on your face, you're infertile. There's always going to be sub-narratives in this. But I almost feel like, and just talking to you on the show here, this idea of your well-being is universal language. It's currency. It's mathematics. And you get to define how you believe you'll be better. But sometimes you don't know what better means for you and you need other people to help you figure that out for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. And it interests me what you've said about having that, it sounds like, real aim and ambition to cling to around your music. In a way that I think talking to other people that have gone through similar treatments, they've told me that recovery and survival can be actually quite a difficult aim to grapple with at times because there's no end point to it. You know, there is no day where you're like, okay, you survive. You can have your appointment where you're told you're in remission or that you have another scan and it's not come back. But there's always that experience you've gone through that you fear going back to. And so it sounds like music was something that was perhaps more quantifiable, something you could cling on to and be like, okay, each day I can get better at this, in a way where surviving through cancer, there's a lot of swings and roundabouts through the treatment.
Yeah, it's really easy to say, you know, find your guardrail, find your handrail, find your anchor. Not everyone can find that. You know, just write, draw, start a blog. It all told us to start blogs back in the day. Write, journal, do your thing, tell the world, share your story. But that isn't always what needs to get you back on track as a human being. I was lucky enough to have a tangible. I get home every day, there's a piano. I could play. I could track my progress. Nothing got in the way of that. And that was what I used because I was lucky enough to have that. And it was a shitty piano, but it was a piano. And it was great. That was what my measure was of it's buying into the cat poster. Not about how long you live, it's about how you live, right? Cat posters. But what does that really mean to you on a day-to-day basis? And I speak and will continue to speak for people younger than me. I'm a Gen Z and millennial advocate because it's not better or worse when you're 80 or 8. It's different because it's the part of your life where you're supposed to be going forward every day and you take 10 steps back when bad things happen. And specifically with rare disease and cancer in particular, the unique factors that make you that in that age bucket are what accelerate your stress and anxiety. How do I take my kids to school? How do I tell my child mommy's got a boo-boo? You know, how do I start dating when I have no testicles? If I have fake boobs, but the surgeon messed up my nipple reconstruction, what guy's going to date me? These are real-world scenarios that stress the fuck out of people who are supposed to be doing normal things, but because they have had, or are living with it, there is no end to this, and you can't be a quote-unquote normal 20-something and 30-something. So there's always this rain cloud over you. If you have the ability to get out of it, that's good for you with the right support tools. But I feel like the idea of you're just getting your life started, you're just out of university, you're just out of school, you're in your 20s, you're in your 30s. But if you can't, that's going to be stressful. That's going to bring out all the stress, all the depression, all the anxiety on top of the shit you already have because you have shit.
Yeah. And then I think with that, there can also be the additional layer of you are looking to get back to a more normal life, let's say when a particular period of treatment ends. But that doesn't mean you are getting back to the time you had before. You've still got through something. There's still things that need to be grieved and, you know, sometimes reminisced about, even if understandably a lot of people that have gone through it with you want to get to the place of, okay, you're better now, sort it.
All right, so your listeners are going to go like, oh, there's that old guy talking about the 90s again, right? So we didn't have the internet. We had nothing. We had television, maybe some cable. We went out to the movies. We had regular money, not Bitcoin and all this crap. Like, it was a different planet. So anyone my age, you know, 55 to like 35, we have an odd perspective on what it means today to deal with a mental health challenge, with or without cancer, like either way. I hate social media. What we're doing now, regular media, perfectly fine. Talk radio, good shit, right? I despise social media. I think it has destroyed our capacity for rational thought and influence and confirmation bias and validation. And you can't say anymore, buck up and tough love and get over it. But at the same time, you can have your cake and eat it too, because this Facebook group or this TikTok page still makes you feel bad about the shit you got right. So how do you balance? My kids are 11. They're going to middle school now. I'm terrified for them because my friends have kids of the same age. And what is it like to be 12 in seventh grade in 2021 versus 12 in seventh grade in 1986, right? This is my generation's voice not understanding. How do we wrap our heads around, do we want to protect them too much? Are we worried about the right things? How do we know what stress and anxiety means today beyond I can't do my homework or people don't like me or I got sexted? We didn't have that crap in the 80s and 90s. So I'm coming to you as an expert in that age group to understand what we can do. Teach us. Let this conversation be a lead into the diseasers out there that don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Oh, you poor thing, you're depressed, get over it. But what does that mean in today's terms?
I think that's a really brilliant way of putting it, actually, that whilst we are doing a great job of moving away from the buck up, you'll get over it kind of mentality, there still is this prevalent social media, not necessarily directly saying, but quite clearly implying of, oh, have a mental health condition, but you've also got to look beautiful. You know, you can see all these influencers that talk about their mental health, and that's really incredible, But there is still a bias, and that's partly algorithms and what people will click on most towards, okay, but you also need to have a stunning photo shoot to go with this blog post or whatever else.
Right. And again, like, I think we're at a social tipping point, at least from my vantage, because, you know, I'm a fairly visible figure in the U.S. in healthcare, is we do not want, and I'm using the royal we, can't speak for every Zizer, I can't speak for all of us, but we are aware that we don't want to just say, oh, we don't want to create the geography war of the cancer days. Oh, breast cancer people go here, colon cancer people go here. If you have a mental health challenge, right, we don't want to create the Hatfield-McCoy wars between who's better off and who's worse off.
Yeah, and that is sometimes how it can feel, that there's, yeah, that competitiveness, for want of a better word. And right, that very right. much exists, I think, and is exacerbated by some of the healthcare challenges. You know, there's that parallel of what gets more funding and what doesn't, what conditions are better known about than others. And so I think you're right. It's very much something that we need to get better at. You know, we need to get better about having the conversations and the understanding in general. But like you say, finding the new language, the ways that the younger generations can wrap their head around this without it all having to be sparkly and pretty and perfect photo shoots, because that's not the reality any more than someone only looking their best whilst going through cancer treatment is a reflection of reality. And it sounds like you're getting a whole range of perspectives on your show. So could you tell us a little bit about the Cancer Mavericks? I'm aware it's already, some episodes are out and it's doing very well in the charts, I noticed.
Yeah, Cancer Mavericks has been an 18-month labor of love that I've wanted to produce for over 15 years. It's the first ever telling of how American oncology went from death sentence to today's narrative, all because in 1971, a very small handful of citizens forced the government to pass a bill under Richard Nixon called the National Cancer Act of 1971. And that set in motion a cascade of changes in society, in technology, in psychology, in biology, in medicine, in best practices. Everything started to snowball from 1971 to get us to here 50 years later. So this is less about cancer and more about the absolutely astonishing human stories of brave people who challenged the government, who went from victim to go fuck yourself, Mr. President, that completely challenged toxic masculinity in oncology and got female voices to get involved in the new way to think about breast cancer and mastectomies, that created the first organizations that did policy work around the human experience of cancer and not just the biology of cancer. It changed the world because the rest of the world is now kind of catching up to what we got done. It should have been less than 50 years, but it's got stellar guests and historic footage. And our production team did like an Emmy-winning job getting this out to the market. So yeah, cancermavericks.com, 8-part series, dropping monthly. Episode 3 drops, I think, next week, August 6th, if I'm doing my calendar right. And we're doing a whole binge campaign in January once it's all up and running. But we're coinciding the concluding episode with the actual 50th anniversary celebration of the War on Cancer Act this December, with the National Cancer Institute here in the States.
Brilliant. So incredible. I definitely recommend the listeners check that out. And they also get to hear your music as well. So there's your progress woven right into how the show works.
So I feel like, have a listen to episode 1. Find yourself in a space you've never thought possible before. Yes, it's about cancer, but it's about people. This is an untold story. And it upset me that it was an untold story, so I decided to tell the story, and we just brought everyone together in a very similar way to cancer survivorship, brought everyone together, because this is, at least for me, the story of how we got from then to now. I'm thrilled, like I said, Bobby, just really emphatically passionate about helping us understand the mental health consciousness that it matters to everyone.
Well, thank you so much.
Take care. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.